and so on, who don't care for men and don't care for human noise and are able and willing to move elsewhere. What happens is then you can get an area of intense activity that is still technically capable of producing a certain number of, let's say, caribou, if you're in thinking only of forage, but it is incapable of producing it simply because the animals won't go there. Well, we have yet to learn how to gauge this loss of productivity accurately, and so I won't dwell on it any further. Another thing, aspect that does interest me quite a bit is the loss of human opportunity attendant on any sort of intensive industrial development, and in this case, oil in the north. It's very obvious that the oil development or the oil ventures in the north will result in some increased opportunities for people. I might mention that the clientele for a guiding operation is certainly vastly increased this summer over last summer in the north. If you are a guide and wish to maximize your economic return, then the people in the north resulting from the oil development are certainly a major positive factor in your existence. I think too that other types of exploration for example metallic minerals will benefit from the presence of oil developments in terms of the camps, the airstrips and so on, once these are more open to public or general use. I think though that we should recognize that the same development eliminates other opportunities, and I'm thinking here especially of two things. One, the impossibility of developing or having wilderness areas with a capital W in places where the oil resources are being developed, because by definition wilderness is impossible in a place where man is as active and as obvious as in the central Alaskan Arctic today. And secondly, I think of the diminishing degrees of freedom available to science in general in that particular part of the Arctic as a result of petroleum exploration and development. And just as an example, I'm sure that you can imagine how long so-called permanent vegetation plots would last if put out by a range ecologist or a phytosociologist any place between the Canning and the Colville Rivers. It's not likely that they would be very useful for, say, a 10 or 20 year study. So I won't dwell any further on these details of what I think are environmental degradation, but we'll ask the question then, if we recognize that what I have said is true, there is reduced production, biologic production, and there are foregone opportunities, then what will our attitudes be toward the new developments to make sure that planning for that region reflects national and statewide and essentially human goals? Three basic questions face Arctic land managers. One of them is, should any oil development at all be allowed on a particular piece of ground? Another is, what rates of petroleum development are best? And lastly, what techniques of exploration, of extraction and transportation should be used on these areas? And my position essentially is that because Arctic oil is a public resource under public domain, then it is the public through government that has the right to answer these questions. I'm sure that a lot of the people in this room are what I call middle-level resource managers. That is, they have a lot of people who they watch when they make decisions, cringe, you might say. And some of you people must have winced when I mentioned this first question, should oil development be allowed at all on a particular piece of ground? Despite Prudhoe, where we didn't even consider the question but went ahead without worrying about it. I think that this question does have a lot of relevance. According to the petroleum industry, and we have heard this several times this morning, all of Alaska's North Slope, most of Arctic Canada, much of the shallower parts of the Arctic Basin, large areas in the Bristol Bay, Cook Inlet, and Gulf of Alaska regions are all potentially oil producers, or gas and oil producers. Now surely it must be feasible in this huge expanse of country to post some areas as off limits to oil development. And this, I would say, must be done when it is justified by high value wildlife, scientific, recreational, or aesthetic resources present on these pieces of ground. These reserves, and incidentally here, there's a tendency to fall into a trap and think that a decision to post an area off limits is immutable. Obviously it isn't. We change our minds all the time. And we might consider then that these reserves could serve for 20 or 30 or 50 years while oil development proceeds in designated areas, and that at some time in the future we or our kids might decide that oil development is the best use of that piece of ground. We may need the oil more desperately than we do right now. And therefore we have then the opportunity to change our mind. I think there are a number of advantages to this strategy then of posting areas as off limits. And one is this retention of a freedom of choice. If we decide to forego oil production in favor of letting a piece of tundra continue its modest yearly production of caribou or peregrines or flowers or what have you, then we can always change our mind. On the other hand, when the area is open to oil development, there are many things which fix this as an almost permanent pattern of land use. Among these things are the tremendous capital investments that are involved. We've heard a lot about that today. And then the fact that when you have oil development on an area, there are physical changes in the land which make it impossible to later change your mind. Another advantage, I think, is one that hasn't been discussed yet, and that is that we may never need the oil that's under these reserved lands, or lands that I propose be identified and reserved from oil development. Oil may become as obsolete for energy as woodlots and hayfields have become. The economic life of Arctic oil fields may be only 20 or 30 years. And if we forfeit wilderness or scientific opportunity of one sort or another for 100 years in order to pump oil for 20, at least we should recognize this fact before we make the decision about the piece of ground. The second question revolved around the rate of petroleum development. Now, since the apparently huge oil reserves in the Arctic will affect the flow of world trade, although there is some disagreement about this, there are certainly political, geopolitical factors involved that I'm only just learning about. Nevertheless, we know from our experiences on the North Slope that the speed at which exploration and development take place has a tremendous bearing on the kinds of environmental problems that we are going to have to deal with. Much of the abuse of the landscape at Prudhoe Bay can be traced directly to the competition between the companies to find and lease the best ground, and to the secrecy which surrounds this competitive atmosphere, and to the economic waste that is also a part of the picture. I think the state of Alaska's haste to get in on the bonanza, as evidenced by this 11th hour selection of nearly 3 million acres south of the discovery area just before the land freeze went into effect, and also by the lease sale, which is to be held in a very few days, I think this haste has contributed to the problem. Well, the implication obviously is that there has to be adequate control of the pace of development, and that this control has to come from the government. As I see it, an essential change that should be made is that the government, not industry, should have the initiative for first exploration on public lands. If competition were eliminated from the exploration phase of the industry's activities, just as it has been eliminated, or nearly so, from other phases of the industry's operations, then I think there would be a much greater chance that we could develop these oil-bearing lands with a more sane approach, and an approach more attuned to the demands of nature and the environment. I don't know exactly how this can be done, but I throw out for your consideration one possibility. Suppose the government were to take the initiative and to say, according to our plan for Northern Alaska, this particular area, let's say now it's in one of the sections of PET 4, this particular area is known from very early exploration work to have some potential for oil. We have not identified any high-value recreational or scenic areas there. We feel free to go ahead and develop this next. Then, when this decision to develop had been made, then the industries would be invited to bid any amount they wished to take part in the original exploration venture. The purpose of the bid would only be to determine the extent of original interest of the companies in this particular piece of ground. And here then, this would be determined by the amount of knowledge the industry had, the particular company had on this piece of ground, and their estimate of their capability to take part in the development of the area. On the basis of this bid then, shares would be established in a certain ratio of 20% to company A and 10% to company B, et cetera, right down the line. And this would then determine the ratio of interest of these companies in the production end of things under a unitization plan. Then the exploration, the intensive exploration, which is always necessary, will go on apace, and at a pace determined by the government in the best interest of the public, which would include the consumers of the oil and the industry and everyone else. I think that if this were true, then there would be no need any longer for secrecy. And this is one of the big factors, I think, in environmental damage in the north and elsewhere. As an example, I will give you an area in Cook Inlet on the north side where there are 6 seismic lines paralleling each other about 100 to 200 feet apart for approximately 8 or 10 miles. These seismic lines are very visible in the forested country because the trees have been removed. Now, I maintain that the same amount of information could have been gained from one of those 6 seismic lines. The only problem was that nobody wanted to tell anybody else what they found. So you get duplicated exploration data because of this competitive atmosphere. And I feel that if you eliminate the competition, you will eliminate much of this duplication and waste. Well, there will be many people who will dislike this un-American idea, and I guess you can take comfort that I would allow the manufacturing and marketing processes of the industry to be just as competitive as they are now, and there may, as I indicated, be some disagreement as to how competitive these really are at the present time. Now, a very important byproduct of a more orderly area-by-area exploration and development is that the pieces of ground that you hold for later exploration will benefit from improved oil field technology. If all of Arctic Alaska had been thoroughly explored between 1930 and 1960, the area would be a disgraceful mess. Seismic operations in those decades were routinely done with CATs, bulldozers run with blades down. Improved technology and more government attention over the past year or two have already lessened the amount of degradation, let's say, per mile, or environmental damage per mile of seismic line. I think the development of hovercraft and other seismic operations will lead to further improvements, so that someday, and this may be utopian, but perhaps not, someday it may be possible for people to find out whether there's oil under a piece of ground without leaving any trace behind them at all. One of the things most disturbing to me is that when seismic exploration reveals that there is no oil, people go away and the damage is still there for others to worry about. Well, this leads logically to my third point, and that is the question of operational techniques. An oil field can be a reasonably nice place to hunt for moose or go canoeing. I think the intensively industrialized half of the Kenai National Moose Range is an example, or it was before the fire. An oil field can be a comfortable and convenient place to do a bit of natural science, too. Whether it is or not depends largely on how much thought goes into field development. And I'm not going to go into detail again as to specific ways that we can improve oil field operations. This is a very large question, as evidenced by the inch and a half thick preliminary stipulations for pipeline building that were developed by the government. But I would mention too that we should consider, and I think Garrett Hardin has expressed this very well in his article on finding lemonade in Santa Barbara's oil, that we should consider that the prevention of environmental damage and the repair of environmental damage should be is a part of the cost of the industry. In other words, these costs should be internalized within the industry rather than being borne now or in the future by the general taxpayer. Well, the best summary of my position on the relation between oil and other land uses in the Arctic is in the closing statements by John Crutilla in his presentation to the 33rd North American Wildlife Conference in 68. And speaking especially of water resources, in a paper entitled Balancing Extractive Industries and Wildlife Habitat, he said this: "We have learned that technological progress has carried us to the point where we no longer need to destroy natural environments which have either scientific research value or special characteristics required for specialized recreation activities in order to increase the output of tangible goods and services. While we can rely on technology to compensate for depletion of certain kinds of natural resources, we cannot rely on technological processes to increase the supply of natural environments which yield utility through direct personal contact." And here he was talking about wildernesses and other recreation areas. "Accordingly, if we wish to leave our heirs the most valuable legacy, we ought to make provision for those assets which appreciate with the passage of time. This we can do with an active policy of intelligent and discriminating preservation of existing natural environments which have characteristics required to serve scientific research objectives and the entire gamut of outdoor recreation wants." In the next few years, let's devise and practice a policy of developing in the North with an eye to all of the riches of this fascinating area. Man's last chance to prove his civility in a pristine environment has begun. There is only one Arctic.
Dr. Whedon alluded in the start to the fact that already some 20, 25 years ago, when rather intensive scientific surveys started on the north, within a few years it was plain that the scientists themselves, or the technical surveyors, perhaps not all scientists, had already done considerable damage to the Arctic lands. They were extremely careless about debris, and particularly in relation to the extraordinary fragility of the tundra as an environment, where one could see, after having just made a simple overnight camp involving two or three men on the banks of a stream or lake, return to that site a year later, and all the litter and the depression of the disturbance of the environment caused by just two or three men camping for a single night were still evident a year later. The tracks of caribou themselves disturbed the tundra and remain in sight for a long time. Now the situation is, of course, 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000 times more serious, because the original inhabitants of the north and the early people had only their own footsteps and their own hands and perhaps a dog with which to operate upon the environment. Now each person there has so and so many, not horsepower, but hundreds or thousands of horsepower in machinery to apply, all of which produces some devastation. It depends on whether you like tundra or whether you like spent horsepower, what you want. And of course, Dr. Whedon mentioned, as was foreshadowed in Dr. Dedeyer's talk this noon, that we're caught in a situation now where we have to make up our minds about what to do for the public welfare and policies and utilization, and we discovered we haven't any minds. Well, that's what part of what we're trying to supply. Unfortunately, a little late, but the next speaker, Dr. Johnson, is genuinely knowledgeable about the tundra as an environment in which plants grow, and we will hear some of that in his talk on the ecology of the tundra of the North Slope.
Thank you once again, Larry. I hope that by now the slide projector is working, and I've been assured that it is, so we'll proceed on that assumption. When I was asked to talk on this subject today, I proceeded on the basis of great ecological summary of what is known about the North Slope. And then later in the summer, Dr. Jerry Brown, who is acting director of a United States effort called the Analysis of Ecosystems, part of the International Biological Program, asked me if I would modify my remarks somewhat to include a description of what is intended in this part of the International Biological Program. So I have done that, and so today what I'll be talking about first of all is what is planned by the United States as a cooperative effort in tundra research, and then a little bit at the second part of the talk will be concerned with some of the specific features of the ecology of the Arctic tundra, particularly in that area, which is called the Arctic Slope or the Arctic Coastal Plain. The International Biological Program is a truly international effort to investigate the properties of ecosystems over the entire world, and there are a large number of countries involved in it. Part of this program, the Analysis of Ecosystems effort, is concerned with this. It's an attempt, I'll read the official literature here, it's an attempt to utilize systems analysis efforts to
to predict the consequences of natural or man-induced environmental changes or stresses in a particular ecosystem. The idea here is to assess what we have left in the world and decide what it's like, what processes are going on in it, in its various parts, and to decide what can be done with it from the point of view of human interest. And that includes both aesthetics and scientific interests, and also economic as well, to best manage these units for the future. There are efforts, in addition to those programs that are contemplated for the tundra, which have really not begun yet, there are efforts in other ecosystems in North America and the world, which include the grassland, the deciduous forest, coniferous forest, the desert, and the tropical rainforest. Have I left anything out? No, I think that's it. The only program that's really operating at any level that's meaningful at present is the grassland program, in which Dr. Van Dyne and his colleagues have organized a large integrated research program in the vicinity, or in northwestern Colorado. The other programs are either in the early planning stages or are only contemplated in the minds of the people who would like to conduct them. The problem is money, as you might imagine it is. I would like in the first slide, if I can start through the slides now. And I think, good. In the first slide, I'd like to show you what's contemplated as a general sort of plan for all of the ecosystems that are being investigated under this International Biological Program. I mentioned that systems analysis techniques are being used, which means that a large body of data are gathered, and these data are analyzed using statistical and mathematical methods. And from these analyses, models, mathematical models are made, which are then used to predict the behavior of ecosystems under different kinds of stresses that might be involved in them. From these models then, and from the observations that are made, integrated research programs are conducted. This is very fascinating, a light show. Just a little faster there. We'll have a strobe effect. Oh, well.
What did you say about the moon?
The moon, yes. That's Actually, I lectured in this room back in 1962, and I think similar things happened. And it also reminds me of when I was here, I was connected with the film program that we used to have. And I remember I was projectionist that year, and I recall having to dash back and forth between buildings in the evenings, getting projectors that wouldn't work, and so this is all very familiar, and I'm not at all surprised.
Progress.
Yes, right. At any rate, I might just, while we're waiting, hopefully for something to happen. The Tundra International Biological Program at the moment is envisioned to consist of several parts. The first is to take all of the data that were collected in the Barrow area, especially those collected between the years 1961 in the late 50s and mid up to the mid 60s, and there was a considerable body of data collected at that time. by a wide variety of investigators who were looking at soils, climates, vegetation, animals, etc., to take these data, assemble them in one point, put them on punch cards, and to prepare a model of how the tundra ecosystem actually functions. This work, if it is funded, and there seems to be some reason to think that it will be conducted at the very unlikely place of San Diego State College, where I happen to be. We have assembled there several people who are interested in the Arctic, believe it or not. Everybody's anxious to get out of the Arctic in the winter, and there's not a more equable climate in the world than San Diego, I suspect. So it's a very delightful place to spend the winter thinking about the tundra, how it is in the summer. This particular part of the program is under the direction of Dr. Harry Coulomb, who was on the staff here at the Arctic Institute of Biology until recently. And so this work will be going ahead at San Diego State in the near future. From that effort, then, there will be an integrated research program proposed for the Arctic tundra. And if enough investigators can be scraped up to actually do it, there will be a research program sponsored in the Barrow area, which will be built on the conclusions that have been reached by applying systems analysis techniques to these data that had been collected at Barrow in these earlier years. I'm not just sure whether we're ever going to see any pictures, but I think I'm just about to the end of this. I'll either have to convert this into a strictly verbal presentation at this point, I guess, or else wait for a minute.
Well, between them, they should be able to take it to pieces.
Chaos will reign supreme for a moment.
Shall I tell some funny stories, Brian, from the old days?
It looks ominous with the core of experts that ran up there.
Well, that's the systems approach. Well, I might make a few general remarks about the Arctic tundra as an ecosystem. One of the advantages of studying this particular ecosystem is that it is presumably simple. That is, there are relatively few species of plants and animals present in the area. And according to the best ecological theory that we have to operate under right now, simple ecosystems are the easiest to understand, which it follows logically, but they are also susceptible to the greatest disturbance. That is, they are fragile, as Dr. Whedon mentioned earlier. They are fragile because there are so few organisms present. If something happens to interfere with the growth and reproduction of some particularly important or critical species in this total system, this creates waves which affect the rest of the system in fairly violent ways. This is why the Arctic is particularly susceptible to disturbance, and why, for example, also an ecosystem like the tropical forest, which consists of thousands and thousands of species and which is extremely complicated in the interrelations between the species present, is less susceptible to disturbance of the sort of that magnitude that would produce a large effect in the Arctic. In my remarks, if I ever get to them, what I hope to do is to look at a particular system that has been investigated, a particular part of this Arctic ecosystem that's been investigated in some detail, and that involves the producer organisms, the plants, and they're particularly that animal which grazes on them most intensively. As a matter of fact, really the only important grazing animal on the Arctic coastal plain, there might be some argument about that, the lemming, and the predators which feed on the lemming, and the various physical and chemical factors which are of importance in functioning of this particular system. Larry, what do I do now?
Well, we thank the audience for their patience so far and hope that it holds out a little longer. I've seen the audiences where the speaker would be already subjected to blows and pop bottles or such a delay. From the appearance of the things still up there, I see no early hope. Do you need a?
All right. Well, let's just forget about the slides, and I'll do what I can with this.
I guess you better finish.
Please bear with me. I'm very sorry about that, but that's what. All right. So we have then a system of collecting data, of analyzing them, of preparing a model of these data, of utilizing this model to propose and conduct integrated research on the tundra. From the data that are collected on the tundra, we will then... Really? Okay. We will then draw conclusions about the real world, which were only too obvious.
What's real about it?
Yeah, what's real about it? And hopefully reach a better understanding of this, the functioning of this particular system. And then be able to make some statements. Why don't we start there, though, and just forget about the first one? All right. At one of the planning meetings, and by the way, I must express my appreciation to the people who are involved in the Tundra IBP for allowing me to use some of the diagrams that they had prepared in their planning meetings. This one was prepared in England a couple of years ago. As a basic sort of scheme of interactions between the various components of, it says, the tundra ecosystem, but as a matter of fact, this could apply to any ecosystem that I know of. We have the boxes refer to the various parts of the system, the atmosphere at the top, including energy sources and gases. Autotrophs simply mean the producer organisms, the plants. We have the soil here as a component of the system. The dead material over on the left is another part. We have inputs of liquids and solids. We have the predators, the herbivores, microflora, the various biological components of the system. And what's involved here, all these lines and numbers that connect these boxes, simply indicate the kinds of interactions that are thought to exist between, that is, showing a particular kind of interaction that exists between the components of this system. Actually, there are 30, I think, or so numbered. Are you a former student of mine? Thank you.
Okay. Now, there's, I think...
All right, well, yes, other problems, but we'll worry about those when they come up. All right, there are 31 of these functions that exist between the components of this system. Now, what the ecosystem analyst would like to know, of course, is the relative sizes of these boxes in terms of their mass, and the particular kinds of functions, that is, the rate at which they occur, between the elements of the system. For example, how much, if we look at item number 3 there, how much of the living material is not consumed by the herbivores over here under function 12, but ends up as attached dead litter, which through process function number 4 is converted finally to become part of the soil. This is the sort of thing we'd like to know. And all of the other numbered functions indicate some similar kinds of relationships of that sort. Now, if we look at the next slide, here's a very simple, this basic model that I just showed you in the previous slide was taken and applied and to make a very simple model of how the Arctic tundra ecosystem might function, specifically referring to the barrow area. Here we have the incoming energy and nutrient pool at the top. 4 basic habitats were identified here. Lowland polygonal ground, ridges, divides, and drain slopes, that's not too clear. Meadows and marshes and thaw lakes, all of which have, or the first 3 of which have ponds in them. These all support primary producers, major plants that are present in each of them. These are consumed primarily, are consumed by herbivores, which in turn are consumed by carnivores. Some of the material from the producers over on the box on the left is decomposed, and the same is true for aquatic systems. And material from all 3 of these producer or secondary producer boxes here then is converted back. Some of the material is converted back into the nutrient pool. Energy, of course, is not cycled, but the nutrients are. And so here's a very simple model, much too simple, of course. It's not real in the sense that it shows all of the kinds of interactions that exist in the barrow ecosystem, but at least it gives a rough framework upon which one can base further study. Now the next slide will show some of these basic habitats. Here, for example, is lowland polygonal ground. You've all seen this sort of thing. I think the focus could be improved there, perhaps. Well, perhaps it couldn't. Can we do anything with a focus on that? Yes? Oh, very good. Excellent. All right, and the next slide shows another view of, again, that last one you recognize the edges of the polygons were raised. This is another type in which the edges of the polygons are depressed. Notice that there are ponds scattered through the area. The next slide shows some of the better drained areas. This is the beach ridge area in the barrow area. This is a drier sort of situation, one of the major habitats. The next one, I believe, shows a meadowy, marshy situation. And the next couple, I believe, show are examples of small ponds that are present in this flat coastal plain occurring in some of these major habitats that we just saw. I think the next slide is another example of that. Oh, okay, and then the 4th major habitat is these large thaw lakes, which are typically oriented in one direction, not always, but often oriented on the flat coastal plain around Barrow. And I can't see much up here, so I forgot just exactly what the next one is, but, oh yes, the next one is a, Yes, all right. Again, I guess that one's out of order. It was another example of ponds within the system. All right, now, a lot is known about this system. And I can't begin to mention all of the individual studies that have been done in the Barrow area. Some of you in the audience have contributed to these. We already know, for example, and we're going to make use of these data now. We know a lot about the soils. We know a lot about permafrost. We know quite a bit about those thaw lakes that you just looked at. Max Britton has proposed a cycle, for example, that takes place within the thaw lakes. We know a great deal about the component species that are present. There are only about 100 species of vascular plants in the Barrow area. We know a great deal through the efforts of Frank Patelka and his colleagues about the lemming and its activities in the Arctic tundra. So we're in reasonably good shape. As a matter of fact, the tundra IBP program is in much better shape than any of the others in the United States because of this great backlog of information that's already present that can be used make a tundra, a mathematical model of how this tundra ecosystem actually functions. The next slide will show a little, well, yes, all right. And the next one. Okay, here, for example, I mentioned the work of Max Britton on the thaw lakes. He has an idea about how lakes expand by the erosion of shorelines. And eventually, this erosion is of sufficient magnitude that the wall at some point in the lake is breached. And then, as you'll see in the next slide, the lake may drain. For example, right here you see this lake presumably enlarged by erosion of shorelines. The wall was breached at this point and then subsequently drained, and that lake then is converted into a lowland meadowy kind of tundra system. The lake above is still partially full of water, but it appears to have drained somewhat from a previously higher level. So we have that kind of information. We have a lot of information about specific kinds of processes, such as frost action in the tundra. And the next two slides are simply examples of the sort of disturbance that one finds very commonly in Arctic tundra situations. Frost heaving occurs and interrupts the plant cover. And again, the next slide, I believe, is another example of that. If we can see the next one. Next slide, please. Yes, all right. A little obscure, but again, a patch of ground that was converted from a tundra situation into bare soil. Now, we know about those things, and we, again, have a pretty good idea of the dynamics of those parts of the system. Now, the next slide, which I'll have to... Okay, now we're concerned particularly here. One of the things I want to concentrate on is the brown lemming and the particular cycle that is known very well now from tundra areas. And that's a particularly bad slide of the brown lemming, but I think you can recognize that it's not a bear or something of that sort. So I'd like to just mention a few of the things that are known about this system. Now, recall back to that earlier diagram, a simple model of the Barrow system. We have the producer organisms, a few species of plants, and in this case, there are probably only three or four species that are really important to support the lemming, a couple of grasses and a couple of sedges. We have one primary grazer, the lemming itself, and then we have a whole series of predators, jaegers, owls, hawks, weasels, foxes, that are feeding on lemmings. And we have the conversion of this, so we have a conversion of plant material to animal material, which occurs cyclically, followed by a downturn in the cycle when the animal material dies essentially, and all of the material that was present in it, the nutrients in particularly we're interested in, are then once again utilizable by plants. So we have a naturally occurring cycle here that takes some 3 or 4 years. I'll just try to outline briefly the high points of a single cycle, just to show you some of the things that are involved. There's a lot of mystery about natural cycles, but Patelka assures us that we can explain the lemming cycle on the basis of events that are intrinsic to the system. We don't have to rely on sunspots or fluorides or atomic bombs or anything else to explain this. So we have then, let's start with a period at which lemming populations are very high. We may have, say, 70 animals per acre, or locally maybe even more than that. At the beginning or at the end of a particular summer and continuing into the winter, there is a great death rate among the lemmings. So much, so large, as a matter of fact, that the numbers of individuals must be reduced down to the point where there are probably fewer than one animal per acre left, or something of that order of magnitude at any rate. Now, this, at the beginning of the next summer, lemmings emerge from under the snow and start to increase in numbers. That year, however, and I should point out, lemmings can breed all year round. They don't hibernate. They can breed under the snow as well as in the summertime. And so at the beginning of that next summer, the population is starting to increase a little bit. The predators that were present the previous year are not there at all, or if they come in, they simply pass through because the populations are at such a low level that they are unable to support the predators that are around. So the lemmings are then essentially predator-free during this first summer. They start to increase in numbers, but the vegetation had been so depleted by their previous high that there is relatively small amounts of food available for their increase. However, during that summer, because lemming numbers are so few, the vegetation starts to recover from its previous overgrazing. And going into the next winter then, we have a situation in which vegetation is partially recovered. We have a slight, perhaps a very modest increase in the numbers of lemmings, and then during the following winter, under the snow, there are probably 3 or 4 generations of lemmings produced, which at the beginning of the next summer, now this is the second summer, have increased the numbers of lemmings per acre to say 5 or 6, maybe something like that. A modest increase, but still enough to be a reasonably important one. Again, they are at such low numbers during the second summer that they cannot support their predators. And again, the predators mostly stay out of the area or perhaps crop a few lemmings that are available, particularly at the beginning of the season when the vegetation hasn't grown enough to afford the animals very much cover. So there is a population increase during the second summer. We go into the next winter then, with the vegetation now having recovered probably something like 50% of its potential from the best that it can do, and that means about 700 to 800 pounds per acre. That's a sort of a rough figure of how much vegetation a piece of tundra will produce, or how much plant material a piece of tundra will produce annually. But probably during the second summer, the vegetation has recovered enough to produce about half that much. Going into the next winter then, there is a substantial increase in the number of lemmings. Again, we have 3 or 4 generations. And by the beginning of the third summer, we have very large numbers of lemmings, which are sufficiently large in numbers to support predators. And during that third summer, predators start, jaegers and owls, I'm talking particularly about avian bird predators now, but jaegers and owls during this third summer will actually nest within the areas that the lemmings are occupying. And raise young, and these young are being raised on primarily on lemming nutriment. And but the predators aren't present in large enough numbers to really do very much to the lemming population, which continues to increase during the summer. There may be a slight downturn, or in some years, actually the third year may be the peak of the cycle. This is a 3 or 4 year cycle, and there are the reasons for this are not clearly understood, but 4 I think is a little more common than 3. Going into the next winter then, lemmings are very abundant. Now mammalian predators like foxes and weasels are present in fairly large numbers. They're cropping lemmings during the winter time. At the beginning of the fourth summer, if this is the year of the peak, now there are predators everywhere. The tundra is alive with activity. There are weasels, foxes, owls, jaegers everywhere. The vegetation now has been substantially cropped off by the lemmings. They cut the standing vegetation. They uproot. They feed a lot underground. They uproot considerable portions of vegetation. And so what they do essentially is eliminate their own food supply. They overgraze the range, so to speak, and make themselves both nutritionally deficient and but also at the same time much more susceptible to predation. At that point then, at the end of the fourth summer, because of this intense predation and because of the lack of food, the population starts to decline. Crashes is another word, but it's usually a little more, sometimes at least, a little more gentle decline than that. All right, well that's the basis of that cycle. Now you see how all these things are tied in together. The plants, their grazers, the predators that are active upon them. Now that sounds very simple, and I think I have several pictures now, several slides which show some of the features of this particular cycle. So if we can go through the next slides, there's the lemming cell. Here are some of the species. Okay, here are some of the species that are important. We can just go through these rapidly. Cotton grasses, next one. Another species of cotton grass, next one. Another kind of situation, tussock tundra, which lemmings occur, the next one. Just a close-up of that, the next one. A typical situation as the snow melts with the old trails under the snow visible, and the next one. Vegetation that was cut during the winter time, still staying around during the summer. And the next. Typical sort of lemming type habitat. Now wait a minute, let's see where I am here in this sequence. And the next one. Again, another, this is a little later in the summer. Notice the contrast between the brown and the green tundra vegetation, early and late. The next one shows cut vegetation from the lemmings. That's not clear enough to really be of any value. The next one, this is the material that the lemmings actually uproot here. This material, pulverized material from underground and above ground parts. And the next one shows the effects of protection of the tundra against lemmings, and exposure showing how the material will look if protected from lemming grazing. And the next one is kind of a summary of all of these activities that I've just described. And I'm not going through all this, but you can see it's very complicated. There are lots of interactions, but still it's a fairly simple system. All right, now, these are the kinds of things that the system analyst would like to look at. Now, it should also be very apparent to you, because we are dealing with a simple system, this is very susceptible to disturbance, And if, for example, something should happen to eliminate any part of it, something should happen to eliminate predators, for example. Suppose for some reason predators simply did not come in to that system that year. This would greatly influence the size of the lemming population, and also would influence what they actually do, are able to do to the plants. I have a few more slides, but I think I'm going to, at the advice of the chairman, truncate my remarks at this point and simply point out then that when we're dealing with Arctic systems of this sort, and I'm not really concerned with disturbance of man at this point, we see that even naturally occurring events within the system are such that they can produce considerable fluctuations in the numbers of organisms present in any particular year. If we introduce the kinds of disturbance that Dr. Whedon mentioned, the kinds that are induced by scientists and oil people and the casual tundra visitor, we can see also that the effects of this disturbance are going to be important in various parts of the system. We should be concerned with the total system. We imagine that under undisturbed conditions that these systems are homeostatic, that is, they are balanced, they function in a prescribed way over hundreds and thousands of years until some major climatic disturbance should take place, for example. And so when we are dealing with the management of these kinds of things, we should be extremely careful that we know what we're doing in the sense of interfering with any of its particular parts. Thank you.
Well, we thank Professor Johnson for his skill in carrying through the interruptions, and also congratulate the patience of the audience, which would now be rewarded by a short interval for which they tell me coffee is ready, and I believe it because I can smell it. So you might try, but please, will you please return in as near 15 minutes as possible.
Yeah.
different species, but it's the same kind of problem. Nobody that I know of takes that mad dash to the sea seriously at all. Well, of course, Disney did a lot of
Thank you.